a few moments and cultivate our motivation. So it's interesting to see what our initial motivation is for being here this evening. And so just to ask ourselves, well, what was my motivation in coming tonight? There's no right or wrong answer, but it's just a way of getting to know ourselves. So whatever our initial motivation was, let's expand it and really have the intention to make our lives meaningful and worthwhile in a very broad way. And so let's aim to develop all of our spiritual capabilities, to purify our mind so that we can be of the greatest and most effective and long-term benefit for ourselves and others, and specifically seeing that long-term benefit in terms of attaining full enlightenment and helping others to do the same. And so let's generate that as our long-term motivation for sharing the evening together. Jordan had asked me to speak on the nature of reality. And I think, you know, maybe he, maybe some of you expected a nice textbook kind of lecture about the absence of inherent existence and the 7-point analysis according to Chandrakirti, which is what I was prepared to give. But I want to talk about it in a very different way. Because reality is not only the ultimate nature, how things actually exist, but it's also the conventional nature, what is our conventional reality of the situation we're in. And so I thought to talk about a little bit about the ultimate and conventional natures in my usual jumbled up way, by talking about it in a personal way, because my mom died about 2 weeks ago. And so I thought to share with you a little bit about how her death and her life and my Buddhist practice coincide, and what effect her death had on my practice, and what effect my practice has had on how I handled her death. So, just a little bit of the background. My mom was 82. She had been declining for quite some time, although, you know, having continual kind of health care crises, and the thought or the hope was that she would bounce back from this one too, but she didn't. And so I was always kind of waiting for the phone call, if you know what I mean. Yeah, when you don't, my parents lived in California, so when you don't live near them, but you know that there's a likelihood that somebody could be very ill or die. And every time the phone rings, you know, it's like, oh, is that the phone call? So it's curious not to have to do that now when the phone rings. But she had, you know, she had heart surgery some years ago, and then old age, lack of exercise, congestive heart failure, gout, so many different things she had. Anyway, she wound up with low sodium, and then must have been, today's Tuesday, so it must have been 3 weeks ago today, she went into the hospital, and then by early Saturday morning she was dead. And it's so strange, you know, when this is the grasping and inherent existence, you know, because we there's somebody that we know for a long time who's had a major role in our life, and we think of them as a real person. They're real, they're concrete, this is who they are. And you have this mental image of who they are in all aspects. Know what I mean? Yeah. And then all of a sudden they aren't there. And you're going, well, wait a minute. I knew exactly who they are. And they're not there. Because they're, you know, the body's there. I saw the body. The body's there. But my mom wasn't there. So then the question goes, well, who is my mom? Yeah, or what is my mom? What is my mom? What is a person that you think is real and then goes out of existence like that, even though the body's still there? Yeah, you got what I mean? So then you say, okay, well, maybe the person isn't the body, because the body's there, but the person's not there. So then maybe, you know, you still have this feeling, well, that person still exists, just they don't exist with their body, but they're the same person. Yeah? And so then you get the whole Judeo-Christian idea of there's a soul. Okay? So there's some soul that is my mother, that kind of separated from this body, but is somewhere else, you know. And if you put it in a Buddhist thing, well, they're going to take rebirth. You know, the soul of my mother is finished with that body, going to take rebirth. But wait a minute, the Buddha said there aren't souls. Yeah, that there's no concrete thing that is the person that is separate from the body and mind. Because if there were, then you run into all sorts of logical problems. Because if it's still my mom, but it got born as somebody else's baby, is it my mom or is it somebody else's baby? And does somebody else's baby have the same personality as my mom? I don't think so. And then did my mom have the same personality her whole life? No. So then who is the person? Who is the person? So if the conscience, you know, if the body's here, the person's not here, there can't be a fixed thing that's the soul. Because whatever the person is changing all the time. Yeah. I mean, definitely in a rebirth, going into another rebirth, it's going to be another person. Yeah. I'm not going to see a baby in 9 months and say, hi, Mom. Hello, Adele. You know, it's not going to work like that. And even when my mom was alive, there was no fixed personality there that was her. Because if you look in all the 82 years, there was a lot of change going on there. So then who is the person? Who is this person? Because it seems like there's somebody so real, and they vanish. And you're looking for what you thought was there, and then you realize it was never there. It was never there. There was never a fixed thing that is that person. So then what does that mean for us? Because I'm a fixed thing And you're all fixed things, right? And we're not going to die. We all know that, right? Death is something that happens to other people. Yeah, it doesn't happen to us. We're somehow immune for that. And even if it does happen sometime later, well, we're just above it all. We're going to sail through gracefully and have our whole personality intact and be like in the movies, float up, go over, plunk down into another body. But if you know anything about Buddhism, who wants to plunk down into another body like this one? You know? I mean, do you want to get born in another body that gets old and sick and dies? Do you want to have another life where you encounter what you don't like and have to struggle to get what you like, and when you get what you like, you have to separate from it, or it isn't as good as you thought it was going to be? You know, do we really want to do that? You go, well, no. But if I don't do it, who am I going to be? Yeah, I got to have a body. I got to have a body to be somebody. Yeah. And that's when, you know, if you study the 12 links of dependent arising, how we take rebirth, that's the craving that and grasping that occurs at the time of death. You know, when we're dying and it's very clear that the consciousness and the body are separating, and we're hanging on to this idea of a real thing that is me, definitely, solidly me. But then we're separating from this body, which is what defines me as being what I am. And then this panic comes of, who am I going to be if I don't have this body? And who am I going to be if I don't have this whole social situation around me with all the people around me who give me my identity? And the whole situation around me that enables me to think this is who I am? Who am I going to be if I separate from all of this? Okay? And that's the... So what happens is we don't want to die, so we crave for this body. When we can't hold on to this body any longer, then we grasp at another one. And that makes the karma ripen. You know, some karma, some imprint of some action we did somewhere along the line ripen, so that our mind finds itself attracted to another body. Yeah. It's not that you die and then you sit up on some cloud somewhere and say, oh, I'm so peaceful and calm. Where shall I take rebirth? Oh, that looks like a nice family. You know, send in your applications and I might accept you as my parents. You know, that's not how it happens. We die very similar to how we live. And if we're living on automatic, and if we're living fueled by our craving, then that's what happens when we die. You know, we're craving, we're grasping. The mind's on automatic. It just goes for whatever looks good. So you begin to think about all these things, you know, in a very real way when you apply it to your life and to the lives of somebody, of people that you care about. Okay, so who is this person that was my mother? And where is she now? And was she, did she exist in the way I thought she existed while she was even alive? In other words, was there a concrete, truly existent, unchangeable person there while she was alive? Was there a real person that even died to start with? Because if such a person were there, we should be able to find who that person is. But if you look in all 82 years, which moment is my mother? Who was the real Adele Green? You know, you can't find. You can't find. Yeah. So there wasn't some solid person who even died, let alone a solid person to be reborn. But there's definitely a continuity there. Yeah, there's there's a continuity of consciousness, even though there's no truly existent person. So karma still functions, cause and effect still functions. But what in the world are we holding on to? What are we holding on to? And that's a little bit more on the ultimate side of who my mother was, okay? The conventional side of who my mother was. My mother was a very intelligent person. And as the rabbi put it in the funeral service, and he got the information from the family, you know, she knew exactly what she thought, and she wasn't afraid to express what she thought. And when she expressed it, it was just coincidentally also what you should happen to be thinking. Okay. So, but my mom was not interested in the Dharma. Yeah. And she didn't read my books. She showed them to other people. My daughter. But she didn't read them herself. She wasn't interested. And so in thinking, you know, of the whole thing of being reborn in samsara, it's for me something that makes me very sad that my mother did not have many Dharma imprints because she didn't have any interest in it. And you can't force somebody to be interested in something that they're not interested in. You have to respect their choices and their decisions. She wasn't really religious in any religion. And so she died very early Saturday morning. On Friday, I had already arranged to fly down to California on Saturday. I had a speaking engagement Saturday morning, but I chose the afternoon flight to go down because I had a very strong feeling that while I couldn't teach my mother of this life the Dharma because she wasn't interested and I can't force it, I had been invited to give a talk for the AA, what was it?
American Association of University Women.
Yeah, AAUW, American Association of University Women. So I had been invited to give a talk to them. And I thought, oh, my own mother of this life I can't teach, but all my mothers of previous lives who come to this AAUW meeting, I can teach. Because in Buddhism, we talk about how all sentient beings have been our mother. Yeah? And it seems very strange to us at the beginning, because, again, this grasping at true existence, no, sorry, there's one mother, and this is her, and it's solid and concrete. You know? But if you really start thinking in terms of multiple lifetimes, and, okay, my present mother hasn't always been my mother. Other beings have been my mother. Then I was thinking, like, all of you have been my mother. And, of course, you know, we don't kind of meet each other now and say, oh, hi there. You know, how have you been doing in the last 50,000 eons? I haven't seen you for a while. You know, we don't kind of have that way of greeting each other. But if you think about, you know, beginningless rebirth and us having been had beginningless lives and having been born as every single thing in samsara, in cyclic existence, and having had every single relationship with every single sentient being, then in all this infinity, there's plenty of time for us to have been each other's parents and children and have had that kind of special relationship that you have as parents and children. Okay, Okay, so although we don't recognize each other this lifetime, there is that connection. And so that's why I chose to take the afternoon flight, because I thought, in honor of my mother of this life, I should try to help my mothers of previous lives who had invited me to give this talk on peace in a chaotic world. And I thought, wow, a group of people who want to hear about peace, this is a special group of people. You know, I need to go and give that talk. And so I went to give the talk, and then in the airport, you know, going down to California, I travel a lot, I'm in airports a lot, but that trip was so special because I had this special awareness of like, wow, all these people around me have been my mother. You know, I don't recognize them, but they've been my mother. And so my whole feeling of being around everybody was really different, because when you think that you've had that relationship of parent-child with everybody, then you don't feel like other people are strangers. Yeah, they don't feel strange. They don't feel like you have nothing in common with them. You know, instead, other people feel very, very close, very intimate. You know, because you have been close and you have shared a lot. And you receive this tremendous kindness from these beings who have been your parents in previous lives. And so even walking through the airport, you know, kind of having this special feeling of closeness with the people around me. And I remember one of the flight attendants, just in the way when, you know, she was serving me my orange juice, you know, there was just some kindness there. And I thought, oh, gee, I wonder if the flight attendants know who's traveling on a bereavement ticket, you know, and try and be especially kind. And I thought, probably not. But, you know, it was just like, there was just something in the way she had said something that struck me as, you know, kind of being very kind. And so, in this relative sense, you know, our relative reality, of having, of not being strangers to each other, yeah, and having known each other and received kindness from each other and loved each other in many, many, many previous lifetimes. Now, that doesn't mean that my mom and I always had a loving relationship, and so that's why I look at other sentient beings with so much affection. That was not the case. I was one of these very good children until I became a teenager. And then, you know, their little sweet daughter, who grew up in the 60s, became a 60s kid. Yeah, which was the opposite, of course, of what they had planned in my life. And eventually, when I did get married, and settled down and went back to graduate school and got a job in the LA City schools. And they thought, oh, finally she's come to her senses and she's stable. I decided to pick up and go to Nepal and study Buddhism and become a Buddhist monastic. And I remember writing my mother the letter, you know, because the Lamas wanted us to ask our parents' permission before we ordained. And I knew that because my parents aren't religious people that they wouldn't be happy about this. And, you know, because they had in life, they had an image of who their inherently existent daughter was and how she should live her life. And it wasn't doing that. And so I said it one point in the letter. I said, well, Mom, you know, I'm trying to live an ethical life and I'm building upon the good things that you taught me, you know, as a child and the values you instilled in me as a child. I'm building on those. And, you know, you should be thankful. I'm not a drug addict. I'm not a criminal. I'm not a prostitute, not a bank robber, you know. And she wrote back and she said, were those the only other career choices you had? And then they didn't speak to me for a number of years. Yeah, quite literally. And they were in great pain about my having chosen to become a monastic. But I thought about it in great depth in making that decision because I knew they wouldn't be happy. But I have a view of multiple lifetimes, and they had a view of one lifetime. And so because of these very different world views, what we consider as happiness differs. What we consider as meaning in our life differs. And so I had the very strong sense that, you know, I wanted to live an ethical life. I wanted to take precepts. And having learned about karma, I knew that if I didn't really get my ethical conduct in ship shape, people who grew up in the 60s know what I'm talking about. And people who grew up subsequently, you know what I'm talking about too. Okay. If I didn't kind of get my life, if I wasn't living in a way that was consistent with my own values, then at the time of death I would regret it. And if I just used my life to do destructive actions that for the sake of my own ego benefit and being incredibly selfish for the sake of my own ego benefit, that in future life, let alone help my parents, I wouldn't be able to help myself because I would have a horrible rebirth. And so I knew that although my parents may be unhappy this lifetime about what I chose to do, I thought in multiple lifetimes, in the long term, if I'm able to practice, then in future lifetimes, when I encounter my parents, I'll be able to have something, hopefully, that is valuable to share with them that can lead them on the path. Whereas if I just went to family dinners and lived the life that they had in mind, I wouldn't be able to be of any benefit to them in future lives, and I wouldn't even be able to keep myself out of a bad rebirth. And so I had thought about that, you know, quite deeply and for a period of time when I made my decision. But they still were not very happy, and so they didn't speak to me for a period of time. And then over the years, as it happened, I was out of the country for many years. When I came back, then we started seeing each other more often. And nothing was ever said, but a reconciliation happened. Yeah. So there was never any discussion, never any apologies, but somehow the mind changed, and so the relationship changed. Yeah. And she did say at one time, like, I don't like any religion, but if I had to be one, maybe Buddhist, because your friends seem nice. And really, that's what made them get a good image of Buddhism, was because of meeting my friends. Because, okay, our daughter's flaky, but she has nice friends. Yeah. But, and in America, we so often grow up with this thing of blaming our parents and seeing our childhood almost as a disease we have to recover from, you know, and grow up with, you know, we love telling stories of all the traumas of our childhood. But in Buddhism, they have you meditating on the kindness of your parents. And so when I was first in Nepal and I heard that meditation of the kindness of my parents, it was, you know, during the time when we weren't getting along because I was 60s kid. And, my teacher said, okay, if you know, thinking of the kindness of your parents is difficult, then whoever it was that brought you up, think of their kindness. So I did that, but I always knew in my heart I had to come back and see my parents' kindness, you know. And so I did, and I kept meditating on that. And it was something that was so incredibly helpful for me, because instead of holding resentment for things that I didn't like when I was a kid, I began to see that instead I had been the recipient of a tremendous amount of kindness from my parents. And I began to see how I had not appreciated that kindness when I was growing up. I was kind of spoiled, basically, going through life with a sense of entitlement of, you know, I'm me, and so the universe should revolve around me. And I should get what I want when I want it, you know, and everything should go my way, and everybody should like me, and nobody should do anything I don't like, you know, especially my parents. My parents' job is to give me everything I want. Of course, I didn't think it that vividly as a child, but that was kind of definitely part of the expectation. Because I grew up in the post-World War II prosperity where our parents were so incredibly generous with us because they had lived through the Depression and they didn't want us to lack what they had lacked. So this meditation, which I did, and I still do, about the kindness of our parents, really helped me to heal many of the things from childhood, and to really have a very different view on my life. In other words, that I had been the recipient of a tremendous amount of kindness, and I have not been very good at repaying kindness or at giving kindness to others. You know what I did when I was a kid? After one of the birthday parties that my parents had for me? Some of you have heard this before. So my parents, you know, had a birthday party for me. And, you know, you think of how a parent's mind when they have a young child, you know, we're going to have a birthday party and all the friends come and there's a clown and there's cake and, you know, how delighted the parents are to see their child have happiness. And so I was had such a good birthday party. And then in the evening, I went in this special corner of my room and I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. Because it was going to be a whole year before I had another birthday. And I look at, you know, what was going on in that child's mind. There was no awareness at all of how much other people had done for me. There was just an awareness of, I want. And it's going to have to be another year before I get what I want. And no awareness of what my parents had gone through to have that party for me. Yeah. So I began to see these things in my Buddhist practice. This was years ago when I first began to practice. And it was so stark. You know, like the kindness of my parents versus the ingratitude of me. And it's a powerful meditation technique because you begin to think, wait a minute, you know, if you have any sense of integrity at all, it's like, I cannot continue this way. It isn't right. You know, as little kids, we're always talking about fairness, aren't we? I think some of our first words as American little kids are, is, it's not fair, you know, that was we complain to our parents when we don't have what we want. It's not fair. But I began to see that I had to say that to myself about how I was interacting with other sentient beings. That it's not fair the way I treat others after what they've done for me. Okay, so my parents of this life, and then if all other beings have been my parents at one time or another, then am I relating to them in a fair way? Or am I relating to them in an unfair way by how I conduct myself and what motivations I have and whose happiness I look out for? So these were the kind of questions I had to put to myself and, you know, really think about. And this is, I think, where bodhicitta comes in, you know, the aspiration for full enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings. And I always had kind of great respect and admiration for bodhicitta. And theoretically, it's just wonderful and I love it. On a practical level, you know, giving up my own happiness to benefit others, even if they've been kind to me since beginningless time, my self-centered thought doesn't want to hear about that. You know, I just want what I want when I want it, thank you very much. But then, you know, somehow bodhicitta is so, it's so admirable, it's so noble when you think of how to make your life meaningful. Wouldn't practicing the path so you can become a Buddha and lead others on the path to Buddhahood be the ultimate way to kind of make your life meaningful and to repay the kindness of others who have been kind to you? You know, it's like the way to go to do that. So, okay, that means challenging my self-centered thought, and that sure isn't easy. And I fall flat many times every day. But just trying to do that, you know, every day, gradually working on it, slowly trying to chip away at some of that selfishness, yeah, some of that sense of entitlement, some of that self-centeredness, and just going along that path, then you have to say that's meaningful. You know? Because in Buddhism, we're not focused on, you've got to be a Buddha by next Tuesday. Our focus is on practicing. Okay? Our focus is on the process. We aim for the goal, but we live with the process. And so our life has to feel comfortable to us and meaningful to us in terms of the process in which we are living. Okay? In other words, if all we have is our goal in front of us, then every day we say, I am not what I aspire to be, I'm a failure. That way of thinking is totally useless and it's stupid. Okay? But if we say, that's what I want to be, and one day I'll get there, so today I'll do my little baby steps going in that direction. And I'm not going to expect myself to be there because I'm not there, but I will rejoice in my baby steps. Okay? And so you just take your baby steps. And when you fall down, you pick yourself up again. Okay? You don't collapse and say it's hopeless. I have a scar here. You've probably noticed it. I have a scar on my face because when I was learning to walk as a toddler, I fell down and I cut my lip on an ashtray. Neither of my parents smoke, but they had an ashtray in their house for people who did. And I cut myself on it. And that's how I have this scar all these years later from when I was, I don't know, a year and a half or 2 years old. Okay. Now, if having fallen down when I was learning to walk, I said, that's it, I'm a failure. You know, I tried to walk. Look, everybody else is walking around me. What's wrong with me? I'm the only one that can't walk. You know, and I not only stood up, but I fell down and I cut myself. You know, so there's the scarlet letter on my forehead. She cannot walk properly. You know, right there, proving it. You know, and so if I had thought as a toddler, okay, well, forget it. I'm just going to crawl my whole life. You know, what would have happened? Yeah? So this mind that we have that puts ourselves down, that sees ourselves as deficient, that just compares ourselves to what we want to be, it's a ridiculous mind. Because that mind makes us stop trying. You know? It's the mind that said, I fell down learning to walk, so I'm not going to try to walk anymore. It's the exact same mind, so that mind is not very helpful. So, you know, I pick myself up. Maybe my parents picked me up, I don't know. I was probably howling. But I did learn to walk. So hopefully one day I'll be able to get to Buddhahood too. Okay, it'll take a while, and I'm sure I'll fall down. And I might have many scars. Okay. But you just keep on going. Okay. So I just talked for a little bit. What I'd like to do is open it and have you ask questions or make comments. You know, because I just talked a little bit about, you know, who is the person that is here one day and gone the next. And then, of course, the relative relationship we have and how we benefit each other and how we train our minds to see other sentient beings. Jane? Okay, so the question is that there is a mind stream that goes from life to life, so isn't there that kind of concrete continuity? There's a continuity, but it's not concrete. Because the mind is changing moment by moment by moment by moment. It's never remaining the same. And what about the mind is the person? Are the mind and the person the same thing? They're not the same thing. Is there anything personal about a mind? Isn't a mind what we call mind, what we label mind? Aren't there just many different kinds of mind? There's, you know, the visual consciousness, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, mental consciousness. Then there's all these mental factors of feeling and contact and discrimination and, you know, concentration and wisdom and anger and love and ignorance and so many different mental states and mental factors. And in dependence upon all these different kinds of consciousnesses, all these mental functions, mental factors, we just give the label mind to show that they have some similarity of having the nature of clarity and awareness. But are any of those mental states a person? Yeah? When you think about it, can you isolate one mental state or one consciousness and say that is the person? Or to put it another way, is there anything personal about the mind? Now, one part of us says, yeah, there's something personal around about the mind. That person has a personality. But what is a personality? Isn't a personality just a series of habits? And what is a habit? Isn't a habit a name that we give on certain behaviors or certain moods or certain thoughts that have some similarity to each other but are not exactly the same? So what is this personality? And if my mom didn't have the same personality from birth till death, then is there some concrete person there? You know, the mind is just all these impersonal consciousnesses and mental functions, you know, that are arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing. And we just put them all together and give the label mind. But what about that as a person? Okay? A person in the way that we think of person right now, which is something real solid with something that makes them them. Okay? Yeah. So we see that in dependence upon the mind and the body, we can impute person. We can give the label person. But neither the mind nor the body is the person. Okay. And you look at it, I mean, because here's where our usual way of thinking and reality just don't always go together. You know, like we think my body, kind of like I am my body, or my body. But what about your body is your you? Start with you. What about your body is you? Yeah? If all your body parts were spread out on a table, would somebody come in and say, oh, there's my relative? There's my dear loved one? None of the parts of the body are us. Is any part of our body ours? What makes your body yours? We say, this is my body. But what in this body is mine? What in this body is mine? This body is just, you know, it's recycled food. Isn't it? I mean, all this body is, you know, sperm, egg, and recycled food. So what about this is mine? Yeah, if you cut it open and open it up, is there something that says, a tag that says this belongs to Thupten Children? Yeah, I don't think so. Okay, so when we look, can we find anything in our body that is either I or mine? And similarly, in our mind, can we find anything that is me or mine or my? You know, we can't. So there's a continuity, yeah, but of the consciousness. But it's not the person.
Yeah, I understand that. I just thought that continuity was more, that part was, if I see it, I mean, I just really, really have to see it. I had enough of these. Like when I see my grandson, I can, he has a, like a flicker of a moment, there's an adult. There's an eye contact, and there's an absolute mind, eye to eye, that I'm not looking at a 7-month-old baby. I'm looking at somebody who's been around a block a few times, and then it's gone. I can see it, and it registers, and there's like a whole facial experience, and then it's gone. And then it comes back. And so, I mean, it's like, I feel like there's that kind of continuity. The other part of my question was, now, I don't know what happens to your mother in her Jewish faith after death, but I have the problem, what do I do about my mother and her grave? Because I don't believe she's there. But, you know, she had always hoped that we would visit and see her as a human, you know, continuing to visit her grave, and it's very hard for me to do because I don't believe, I believe that she's wherever she is.
Yeah, she's gone. Yeah. Okay, so your question is kind of about, you know, your mother's grave and your mother feeling that wanting you to come there and see her as still being there. Yeah, my mother was buried as well. But, well, except here it's interesting. I say my mother was buried. Actually, my mother wasn't buried. It was her body that was buried.
Mine was cremated, so there wasn't even a body.
Yeah, right. But, to me, I think that the place of the burial or that stuff doesn't have much meaning. I mean, I'm much more concerned with the unfolding of her karma and where her mind stream is than with what happened to her body. Yeah. And so I do, you know, dedications, and I made donations on her behalf and so forth. Because, you know, wait a little bit longer, even this planet Earth isn't going to be here, so, you know, no sense hanging on to any of this, the material stuff. Did you have a question, Pam? Yeah, your hand is kind of like it's
trying.
So you had a comment and a question. So your comment was, isn't it more important what the actions a person does rather than whether they've studied the Dharma or not? And definitely yes. You know, it's not about saying, look, I have my refuge card, you know. you know, that's not what's important. That's clearly how one behaves in life. And then your second thing was that you have a friend whose 3-year-old grandson is going to die very soon, and what can be done to help in this very tragic situation. So I think in terms of helping the child, who is, you know, we tend to think of helping the adults, but helping the actual person who's going to undergo this transition. I think having a calm, tranquil place, environment, so that when, you know, the body stops being able to support the consciousness, there's just quiet and peace so that the child, you know, the consciousness can absorb. And so the parents are, you know, certainly going to be grieving a lot, but if they could keep their grief away from what the child when the child's dying, because that could be upsetting to the child. And so a serene environment. And then if you can say mantra, I don't know the situation, you know, if the family is open to Buddhist practice at all. Because I was going to say, if they were open, you could say mantra out loud. So that the child could hear it, that puts good imprints in the child's mind. If the family's not open, then just do the mantras yourself. And then if you can, just blow on the child, like transferring that energy to the child. We say in Buddhism it's good to avoid touching the body right after the breath stops, that it's better just to leave some time, because the consciousness doesn't leave the body at the time that the breath stops or the heart stops or even the brain stops. It can take some time for the consciousness to absorb and then finally leave the body. So it's best that the body be untouched during that time. And then when the body is touched, then to touch it at the crown and kind of, if you can say out loud, you know, be born in the pure land or have a precious human life, do that. Or just think that and think it very strongly and try to communicate with that consciousness in that way. Yes, it's very good to do other prayers and make offerings for somebody who has died. So the King of Prayers, and for all of you who did that for my mom, I want to really say thank you. So doing that, offering, also it can, you make offering and then dedicate. You can make offerings to charities or to religious organizations or whatever, and then you dedicate the merit for that for the benefit of the other person's rebirth. May they have a good rebirth. So that's things. Or their personal belongings to give those to charities so that other people can use them and benefit, and again, dedicate the merit for that person's enlightenment and their good rebirth. In terms of the parents and how to help them, you know, I would have to know them personally and what their worldview is in order to...
He's a minister, so...
Oh, he's a minister. Okay, then. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it might shake their faith. I mean, sometimes people who have... faith in a creator God, then when something like this happens, they begin to doubt their faith. So, you know, you have to see where the people are at and what's going through them. But the most important thing is for them to try and have a mind of loving kindness. Yeah, and of course they have loving kindness for their child, but to say, can you spread that loving kindness to all the children in the world? You know, some of you may have read, I had requested Sirkham Rinpoche to do prayers for my mother, and then he wrote this one little verse. I put it on the web, and it's very sweet. And he talks about in her future life, may she give love to all the children in the world. And it's a beautiful idea to think of, you know, somebody that you care about being able to give love to all the children in the world. And so to say to the parents, you know, please extend the love you have for your child to all the children of the world. Yeah? And see if they can, you know, come out of themselves to connect with other people.
Mm-hmm. I had a question, which I'm going to try not to stumble through. But, I was thinking about when you were talking about how we crave another body, like end up in another body. So yeah. I was thinking about that, and the craving that we do in this life. Mm. And so what I was thinking about is, like, it feels like what we crave in this life is an experience that we want over and over and over. Because, like, we like that experience, so we keep craving to have that experience. So what I was trying to put together was, like, when we die and transition out of this body, it's like, are we craving that to have that experience again, and it happens to come in the form of another body, but it's, like, an experience that we...
Okay, yeah, I understand what you're saying. So you're saying in this lifetime, a lot of our craving centers around experiences.
Yeah.
You know, we had a pleasurable feeling from some experience with a person or the environment or whatever, and we react to that pleasant feeling by craving to experience it again and again and again and again. And so does that happen? Is that the kind of craving at the kind of death? Are we craving for the experience of just having a body or being alive?
Yeah.
I think that could be part of it, but I actually think that it's a different, most of it is a different kind of craving. I think it's more a kind of grasping at I am, and I want to continue to exist, you know, and it's a fear of being non-existent, and if you take a body, then you're going to be existent, okay? Mm-hmm.
Body and existence thing, it's been very confusing for me over the past weeks because I found myself watching myself sleep. I'm asleep, or at least the body's asleep.
Watching yourself sleep.
Yeah.
Okay.
The body's making sounds, like maybe it'll snore, and I'm going, it's snoring, it's sleeping, what am I doing? And I don't know.
Okay.
I have this experience of not being the body, and I don't know what relationship with it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, my awareness, it's doing something without me.
Yeah. Okay. So this whole thing of, you know, in what relationship are the person and the body? How do they have a relationship? Because so often we go through our life feeling, I am my body. And I control my body, but you're having the experience of the body sleeping, but you're not feeling tired, and here's this body sleeping.
Making noise, what is it doing?
Yeah, making noise, whatever. So, you know, what is the relationship between the person and the body? So we have to discriminate a few things here. We have the body, we have the consciousness, and we have the person. Okay? And these three things exist in relationship to each other. Yeah, but they're not the same thing. We tend to feel sometimes that the body is the person. Like when you get hurt, you say, I'm hurt, meaning the body's hurt. So we feel like the body is the person at that time. But then if that were so, then we couldn't have the kind of experience that you're talking about where we have the feeling of observing our body, which we've all had, right? You know, we've all had that feeling of like observing the body and saying, it's not me, it's a body. Yeah. Haven't we all had that experience? Yeah. I mean, even sometimes we say, I hurt, and sometimes we say, my hand hurts. That indicates different relationships. When we say, I hurt, we're somehow confusedly thinking that I am the body or associating the I with the body. But when we say, my hand hurts, there's some distance between I and the pain because it's the hand that hurts, not me. Okay, so we say both of these sentences conventionally, my hand hurts and I hurt, and they both make sense. But in neither of them can we find a solid, concrete person there. Okay, in neither of them can we find a solid, concrete person. Similarly with the mind, sometimes we say like, I'm thinking. Like the mind is the I, or the I is the mind. The I, this I, not the this I. Okay, so the person is thinking. So I'm, the consciousness is thinking, so I'm thinking. Or sometimes we'll say my mind is thinking. Yeah. So both of them we say conventionally, but they also have to show slightly different ways of seeing the relationship between the person and the mind. Yeah. When you investigate with analytical wisdom, you can't find a person in the body or in the mind. Okay? A findable person that exists from its own side, you can't find either being the body or being the mind or existing somewhere within the body and mind. But what we do see is that in dependence upon the body and mind, the label I is given, and in that way a person comes into existence. So what we call the person or the self is something that exists in dependence on the body and mind, but also in dependence upon the mind that conceives and labels person or I. Okay. So what we call the I, although it seems like it's such a real thing findable there, when we investigate, we see there's nothing findable there. But it doesn't mean that there's no person at all, because we do say, I'm here, and that's totally valid conventionally. But we come to see that when we say, I'm here, or I'm doing this, I'm doing that, that I is one that exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon the combination of body and mind. But when you search to find exactly what that is, you can't find it. You can't find anything. Okay? And so here is where you get in Buddhism when they talk about things existing like an illusion. That's it. They appear to be solid and real and independent, but they don't exist in that way. Okay? So that's kind of what's happening with you, you know, the sense of self. What is it? Yeah. And it's very interesting when we explore this sense of self that we feel is in control. Do any of you have problems with being control freaks? Yeah? Several of us are control freaks, huh? Like, I gotta control everything. You know, I gotta control myself, and I gotta control the people around me, and I've gotta control the environment around me, because I exist, and I am the controller. But then you start to ask yourself, you know, who is this I that's controlling everything? Yeah. And you can't find it. And then you start asking yourself, how much control is there really? You know? And we begin to see, you know, we try and control everybody else, but, you know, fat chance. And we can't even control ourselves, can we? You know, if we could control ourselves, would any of us get old and sick and die? You know, if we had control, we wouldn't do that. Yeah. If we had control, would we get angry and say mean things to the people we love? No. You know, but we're out of control. So it's a very interesting thing to look at. And it should hopefully provoke us to do some Dharma practice. So we begin to see that this whole endeavor to control everything is fruitless. And it's much better to learn how to behave in beneficial ways. Yeah.
Seeks non-existence. Mm-hmm. You know, not it doesn't feel So it's not driven by fear. It lacks craving. It lacks engagement. It lacks the energy or the, you know, the will to engage. What would be the force then that would
Okay. So the question is, I spoke about the craving for existence and the grasping for existence, but what about somebody in a very depressed state who has no wish to exist and no energy for it anyway? You know, it's interesting, because sometimes we'll say, well, somebody who's depressed doesn't have much of a sense of self. Actually, from a Buddhist viewpoint, they have a very strong sense of self. There's actually a lot of self-grasping when we're in depressed states. Very, very strong self-grasping. Because there's a huge I that is miserable. And there's a huge I that is dissatisfied with everything in the world, including itself. So it looks as if the person doesn't have a sense of self, but actually there's very strong self-grasping at that time. And when the person dies, even though when they were alive they may not have had much energy to do anything, that doesn't mean that the grasping for existence has ceased. Because they may not be grasping at the pleasures of this life because they're in a depressed state, but the grasping just for I am. Yeah. The grasping at the sense of a real I is still there. It's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes we feel when we're depressed, oh, there's no sense of self. Look again. Look again. I mean, I know, because before I met Buddhism, I used to, you know, get quite depressed. Boy, was there a strong sense of self going on there. Huge sense of self. In fact, I could barely see beyond myself. You know? I couldn't see other people as having feelings and emotions because I was so involved with me who was so miserable. That's why His Holiness says that recommends compassion as an antidote for depression. You know, we kind of go, compassion is an antidote to depression? How can I have compassion for others? Because I don't have compassion for myself, and that's why I'm depressed. Yeah. But, you know, what His Holiness is saying is like, pull your awareness out of this vortex, spinning vortex of me, I, my, miserable, and see that other sentient beings are out there and they have feelings just like you and they want to be happy and avoid suffering just like you, and they've all been your mother and have been kind, and in all the roles in society they do, they've been kind, and like, open your eyes, you know? That's what His Holiness is trying to get us to do by saying that, you know, employing compassion as an antidote to depression. Because when we are looking at others' experience with compassion, we can't be funneling on poor me, poor me, poor me at the same time. Yeah? And when we're very self-focused, then everything is self-oriented and everything becomes miserable. Whereas when we're other focused, then what happens to ourself isn't so important, so the mind becomes so much more easily satisfied. Try it. Really? Really, it works. It works. Okay, so let's sit quietly for a few minutes. So just remember something that you heard this evening. and think about it. It'll just be a short meditation. And remember it so you can take it home and think some more about it. And maybe even apply it in your life. And as we dedicate the merit, the positive energy that we created this evening for all sentient beings, let's think specifically of this baby who is going to die, of the child's parents, and extended family, of my mom, and of everyone here who has lost someone dear to them, because we all have. And so your dear ones, whether they're your parents or children or spouse or friends, let's dedicate for all of them that they may have hearts of loving kindness for themselves and all others. That they may have hearts of wisdom that counteracts craving and grasping by seeing reality as it is. Let's dedicate so that in this life and all our future lives, we can bring benefit and kindness to all the other living beings who have all been our parents and have been kind to us. And to do that, then may we subdue our own self-centeredness and learn to find joy in giving, to find joy in caring about others' welfare, and to find joy in working for others' well-being. So may we see that benefiting others is the same thing as benefiting ourselves. And that benefiting ourselves means to have a heart that benefits others. Because our own happiness and others' happiness are completely intertwined. And let's dedicate so that through our fortune at having met the Buddhist teachings, we may be able to spread these teachings to all beings in whatever form is most suitable for them to help them along the way.